The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can. Pursuing it with weary feet until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then I cannot say. Before I start into the story of today, I just want to say that I am awash in many things right now. The song that a lot of you missed that Anthony and the worship team sang at the very beginning, oh man, I was like, that could be the sermon. And then, you know, when you guys started praying, I was like, well, that could be the sermon. And so I feel really humbled by the idea that this whole thing is the sermon, it's the worship together, and you all are part of it, and I'm going to be saying things that probably you've thought of, and I'm going to be reminding of you of things that maybe you know, and I say that because your prayers were pretty spot on, so I think I just want you to know that I feel that, and I feel really humbled in that, in this moment, and connected to you. So, let's start. Today, I am not primarily a theologian. I am primarily a storyteller. And so today, we're not going to be very, chapter and verse. We're going to be really storied. And so we're going to be kind of rising up over the story of John and looking at it from a certain lens and kind of an overview. And so we're also going to be looking at the story of Bilbo and Frodo Baggins, the hobbits, because I love those stories and they fit. So that's where we're going. So to start out our story, we start with, in the hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. Now, this wasn't a hole like you might imagine, a cave. It wasn't dark or dank and wet or dry. It was a really nice place. It had really nice chairs, and Bilbo, the hobbit who lived there, he had wine in the cellar. He had cheese and sausage to eat, lots of breads, and it was a place he really preferred never to leave, other than to sit on his front porch and smoke pipeweed. And into his life came a wizard. And the wizard came and knocked on his door and invited him to an adventure. And Bilbo said, "No adventures for me, thank you very much. I prefer to stay here. If you would like to have tea, come see me in a week and that will be fine." And after he shut the door, Gandalf the wizard put a mark on his door. It looks kind of like an F. It was a dwarven symbol, I believe, and it meant thief. And so pretty soon, as evening wore on and Bilbo sat down to eat his wonderful dinner that came from his wonderful cupboards that were so full, there was a knock at the door. And one by one, dwarves began to arrive. And they began to eat his food, and they began to sit in his living room. And pretty soon that wizard, Gandalf, from before, arrived as well. And they laid before him the adventure that they were inviting him on. Turns out they needed him to be the thief who went with them on the journey to steal the treasure from a dragon that was theirs. And Bilbo was like, I'm not a thief. I'm not capable of this. Why are you asking me? And as the story goes, the next day the dwarves left, the wizard left, and Bilbo was of two parts. One, the adventurer, the Tookish side, and one, the one who wanted to stay in his hobbit hole, the Baggins. And the Took side won out, and he took off down the road on the adventure. And his life was changed. So why did I bring in this story? Because I love Tolkien, first of all, and I feel like he was writing a story that tells us about an adventure we're invited on. And this adventure takes place when evil in the story, Bilbo doesn't know this yet, and we don't really know it by the end of The Hobbit, but it's happening. And so the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, which is the next book where Frodo is then drawn into an adventure, we realize that there is an evil spreading through Middle-earth, wanting to take control of everyone. And it has everyone under an enchantment. And the tool of enchantment is a ring. And the one who is wielding it is Sauron, the evil one. And everyone is crushed under the boot of this enchantment. And it's a dark time. And the temptation in the dark times is to go and just barricade yourself in your little hobbit hole and live your life and not interact with it, not experience it, or to get up a lot of energy to fight it and to get involved in it. And I found myself asking, because I feel like we're in a dark time, I found myself asking, what does God ask of me in a dark time? What adventure is he inviting me on? Now, one of the important, there's two things about Tolkien that you need to understand that undergird his story, and I think it really fits with the story of Jesus, and this is, first of all, hope. Now, Christians tend to have a happy-go-lucky idea of hope. Like, everything's going to turn out great, and this is going to be so great. And Tolkien kept saying, no, this, it's really important in a story that when your characters are moving through it, they have this hope that, I hope things will turn out well, but there's no surety in the moment. And what that looks like is, it's hard, and it's dark, and I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm going to keep going. That was very important to Tolkien, that hope wasn't cheaply brought to the table. The other thing that Tolkien talks about that I want to share with you before we jump into the story of John is an idea called eucatastrophe. And this is a word he created. Tolkien, the man who wrote The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, was a philologist. He also studied mythology and medieval history. And so loving fairy tales, there was one particular fairy tale, which I love to tell, called The Black Bull of Norroway. It's a Scottish tale. And he, from that tale, created this idea of a eucatastrophe. And he said that the biggest example of eucatastrophe was Christ and his death. And the idea of eucatastrophe is that everything seems to be going a dark direction. Everything points to this is the worst, this is the end, all hope is lost. And then out of the very thing that brings disaster comes this glorious, beautiful life, this eucatastrophe, a change in direction. So that's the introduction. That's the invitation. So my invitation to you today is to look at with me the adventure set before you. And maybe, just maybe, with me, maybe you already are, but maybe you need a reminder, step out of your hobbit hole. I need it. I would prefer to stay in my hobbit hole. I really like cheese. But so the encounter, the first invitation is this encounter with the love and the presence that we sang about all morning, Jesus. And so I want to go to the Gospels and read, even though I'm kind of overviewing John, I want to read Matthew 4, 18 through 20, when Jesus called his disciples. And it says this: "While walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, 'Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men.' And immediately they left their nets and followed him." And so this is a really beautiful picture, actually. So Jesus went to these men who their economy, the way they participated in the economy was to sell fish, to fish for them and then to take them and sell them, and then they would make their living. And Jesus came to them and he said, "I am inviting you out of the economy you're in and into another one. where it's not buying and selling, and where you have to die to the way that you've been living and come to a new way of living, to a new kingdom. I heard someone pray about that this morning, to the kingdom. And he said, not only am I inviting you into the kingdom, I am going to help you. I'm going to invite you to cast a wide net and to bring in the fish, the men and women, the people. And so this is a pretty amazing invitation. And they dropped their nets and went with him. I wonder why. Why did they just drop their nets? Why did they just all of a sudden step out of the hobbit hole and go? I wonder. That's a really good thing with stories, is to just wonder. Not really necessarily get the answer, but wonder. But one of the things I wonder about that is, what was the nature of Jesus in that moment and how he shows up all the time throughout the story of the Bible? He calls us where we are, and he calls us under an enchantment. We are under the enchantment of the world. And it's like the ring. There are many ways that shows up. One is some of the world is under the enchantment of power. How do I gain power? How do I have power over others? A lot of times under the materialistic enchantment that I have to gather as much as I can in this world to be safe. Or maybe fear. Out of fear, we create tribes that become echo chambers. That means we're in our tribe and we can say, this is what is, and nobody disagrees with us, and we have our little group, and we look at the group over there and we go, they're wrong. And that group's over there creating an echo chamber and just hearing their own ideas and not open to others. And that's an enchantment. That's a belief that we can be safe that way. And I find, too, that a lot of times, for me, an enchantment that comes over me is the enchantment of dissociation. It's too much. The world is too much, and I dissociate, and I get on my phone. I know I always say that in sermons. I'm working on getting off my phone. I really am. But it's really easy to just sit and scroll and scroll and scroll and find out what's going on here and there, and it's an enchantment. So, the people of Israel and then the Christians after were living in what I think are the last days. Now, I want to warn you, I'm not preaching about eschatology today. Eschatology is the theology of the end times, of what the judgment and of the end. And I am not preaching about that. So you can relax. Because many years ago, that was something that Christians would use oftentimes to the last days to talk about who's in and who's out. And I don't see that completely in Scripture. What I see, and this is what I found was interesting when I was looking at the story and have been lately, is that the disciples believed that they were in the last days. That's how they wrote the New Testament. They would talk about Jesus coming being imminent. And as I thought about that, I thought, well, they were in the last days. They, for the Jewish people, after Jesus left the earth, they went through a horrible period of time that was like last days. The Christians went through a horrible time of persecution. It was like last days, and Jesus was indeed coming for them. And I believe that throughout history, we have lots of last days. I believe that if you live in Sudan right now, it is the last days. If you live in Gaza, last days. In Congo, in Haiti, I mean, in Ukraine, the list goes on and on. There are so many cultures who are in a time where they might be annihilated, and horrific things are happening to them. Israel is afraid. People are afraid that this is the end. And so I was really looking at that going, okay, so then what does Jesus ask of us in the last days? And then I thought, are we feeling kind of some last day things? And I thought, we're not in the same space as people all over the world, but we are in difficult times. We are in a time where everyone would like to rip one another apart, that we are in a battle, in factions all over our country. We're also in a time when the powers that be and the principalities have no care for those in our space or around the world. And I'm not talking about one side or the other of those principalities. I'm talking about all of them. And so it feels dark. There are lots of worries about where will our money come from? What will happen in our world? And as we begin to tear each other apart. And into that space, I say, well, Jesus, what is it that you ask of us? What is the adventure you're inviting us on? And I believe that Jesus invites us to wake up. Now, there is a wonderful guy that I've been following. His name is Dr. Martin Shaw. He's a storyteller and a mythologist. And about 4 years ago, he went out into the woods for a wilderness journey or something, and he met Jesus, and he was transformed. And he came back, and he says this quote. He says, "I don't really like the word enchantment. I never did. I feel that our culture is so enchanted, so trance-stated. I never see my teacher. I never see Jesus really as an enchanter. I never imagine being enchanted by him. I imagine being in a fairly alarming state of waking up with an enormous amount of compassion attached, but woken up. I suppose it's a bit like coming out of, I suppose it's a bit like coming out of pain meds after surgery." And I think that this idea happened to Bilbo and to Frodo, this wake up, and to the disciples, that when Jesus asks us to step out of the economy of our existence, our way of being, and into something different, it's going to feel a little troublesome at the moment. And at the same time, it's an invitation that's very hard to resist. And so we're going to see that in the stories we've been following, that Jesus, not only did he awaken his disciples, but he invited person after person into this. And we're going to go over how that happened. And the disciples not only were awakened themselves, but they watched as others were awakened. And I think that's an important thing for us. I think that's important, too, in regard to sometimes even the impact stories, is when we're hearing about the ways that Jesus has awakened others. There's something about that for us in this adventure. And it's something about the purpose of what I believe he's calling us to in the last days. So if you go through John, we've gone through it together. We went through the first thing that Jesus did was he made water into wine at the wedding of Cana. And he saw their need there for him. And then we have, I may be getting the order off, I believe that he cleansed the temple. And then we had Nicodemus, who he spoke to, who Nicodemus was like, "Tell me what I need to do, all the things I need to do." And Jesus says, "You have to be born again out of the economy that you're living in into my kingdom, a new birth." And then we had, after Nicodemus, I think it was the woman at the well, and then the man by the pool we've had just recently. And then the woman caught in adultery, and on and on. And each time Jesus meets us, he meets us as the presence that changes us. And he invites us to believe him. To believe him that he loves us as we are, and his love will change us to be one who loves. Why is that important? Because we come into this world grabbing for either connection or protection. As I was thinking about that whole idea about we're wired for connection or protection, one of the things I realized is that a baby is not necessarily giving connection. They are pulling for connection. because that's a survival instinct. We're all born with this survival instinct. And we're all born looking to either push away what's uncomfortable or pull to us what the love that we need. And we'll pull it from even a parent who's not necessarily giving it well because we're desperate for connection. And so Jesus, in meeting each of these people, he came to them in that state. And he said, I am the living water. I am the bread of life. I am the one who will fill you with myself. And you will be shifted from my presence, from taking to being able to stand up and love when it's not safe, when it doesn't feel safe, when it doesn't feel good, when you may not receive love back. And that's the invitation, and that's what he does. He sees us where we are. He loves us where we are. He accepts where we are, and then he shifts us. And so Jesus said many things to his disciples. And I mean, we have that story of him showing little by little, his disciples saw person by person being shifted by his love, by his transforming invitation. And we get to the end, and I'm not going to go too deeply into this, but John, kind of like in The Lord of the Rings, if you've ever read The Lord of the Rings or watched the movie, you know that there are like five places where you think that they could end the story. I mean, it's kind of interesting. It's like, oh, that's probably the end, and then there's more. And I feel this way about John. When we get to the end of John before Jesus dies, right after he's washed his disciples' feet, we get to the place where John keeps going. So you've got like three chapters of Jesus sharing things with his disciples and then ending with a prayer for them. And so I want to just focus on one of the things he said. John 15:12-17. He says, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. So Jesus goes on to talk to them about abiding in him, the vine and the branches. And I thought a lot about this as I was thinking about this time, these last days, which are not the end of all days, maybe, but the last days, this time when things are really hard and it feels like the end and we're not sure what the hope is. And one of the things I noticed that he does is he, after transforming us with his love, and that is a journey that takes time. Even the disciples were not at this point fully transformed. In fact, Peter, Jesus said to Peter, you're going to deny me three times. You know, he wasn't fully transformed yet, but he had that exposure to the presence of Christ over and over, that transforming love. And Jesus then invites them to love one another. So I just found myself just thinking about that's what he says in the last days. He doesn't say, make sure your portfolio is secure or make sure that you have enough food stored downstairs. Although those things aren't bad to do, and please don't go and, you know, take care of your portfolio. It's okay. But I think to put our trust in those things at this at the times when times are hard is going to be empty. And he says to them, I want you to believe my love, and I want you to love one another, and I want you to abide in my love. And so I was thinking about the mechanism of that. And as you know, in addition to being a storyteller and a pastor here of children and a therapist. Well, actually, in addition to those things, I'm also a therapist. And I'm also really deeply ingrained into brain science. I love to study it and to learn about it. And one of the things that I love to talk about, I've probably talked about it already here, but I'm bringing it back in, is this idea of what makes us able to love. Now, in the counseling world, there's this buzzword called self-regulation. This idea that we need to regulate our system, some of you are nodding, you know, and bring it back to homeostasis. And it's very important to know that that doesn't mean calm. That means being present with ourselves, with who we are. And that is because when we feel fear or we feel worried about what's coming towards us, our automatic response is to mount a defense against whatever that is or whoever that is. And when we mount that defense, we do two things. We disconnect from who we are. We don't love ourselves. In fact, sometimes the things we do to mount a defense are very, very detrimental to ourselves and to others. And so we are unable to connect to anyone. That's the idea that we cannot protect and connect at the same time. And so in the therapy world, self-regulation became very much a buzzword and a, you know, you need to get on that self-regulation and you need to love yourself too. And I find it fascinating because this is the thing about brain science. You have to understand, I'm going to say some things to you about the brain, and in 2 years, they may be different. We are on the cusp of like understanding the brain like we never have, and so take this with a grain of salt, but it's actually a really beautiful grain of salt, so stick with me. You can't self-regulate. That's the newest, that's what the understanding of the brain is. We can't self-regulate. We can't even self-love. What? So it's very popular in therapy to talk about those things, but we have to take a step back and understand the mechanism of the brain, and this is going to blow your mind. So when a mother, let's just do this, and I'm oversimplifying, overgeneralizing this, so don't take it too deeply, but when a mother feeds her baby with her breast, it's a wonderful experience. And in the baby's brain, neurons are firing. Doot, 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 you know. And if the mother is smiling or connected or singing or feeling light and present, and I don't mean in a fake way, I mean really there, that starts firing. And you might have heard that what fires together wires together. Have you heard that? That the write it down. The neurons that fire together wire together. And pretty soon, they create a neuronal network in that baby's brain of their experiences with their mother. And that neuronal network is in here and there for that baby. So that as the baby grows up, when they have an experience out in the world and they need regulation, there is a possibility that they can go to that neural network and go, oh, that's what I need to do. Okay. Conversely, if a mother is feeding her baby and the neuron is firing and she is stressed or afraid, or maybe something's going on in her relationship with her husband that's not so good and the two of them are at odds and she's sitting there stewing about it while she's feeding the baby feels that. Even if the mother is going, hi, here's some milk, right? The baby doesn't catch that. The baby catches mother's nervous system. And it wires up feeding, stress, not so good of us, mom's not feeling good. It all wires that up. And that becomes a neuronal network. And you might end up growing up and having a hard time when you're eating. Like, ugh, I hate to eat. I don't feel good about it. Or other things connected to that will come up automatically because that neuronal network is speaking to you. Isn't that crazy? And so when we tell a person to love themselves or to regulate themselves, they can't do that without an external lover or regulator. And it's to the point where a lot of times I'll hear people in marriage kind of thingies say, oh, love is not enough in a marriage. And I always want to say, oh, you are so wrong. But I know it's because you're talking about a fluffy love. You're talking about a feel-good love. And what you have to understand is that real, true love that works through the neuronal networks, that is present for the despair that might happen because of how that got hooked up, or the pain or the trauma, that is aware and awake and is present, is what shifts the dial. And then what happens is, as you and I are loved by our Father, He becomes that neural network in us. Jesus is in us. He is the neural network. And if our mom is that neural network, it is Jesus in us. Any good that comes to us that causes us to love ourselves and love others comes from Him, comes from His love of us and His invitation to us. And it comes, and even better, I'll tell you this even better, and this is important for the next part. If the mother is feeding their baby and it's wiring, and it's kind of regularly, she's kind of wiring this discontent, and she repairs that. So she's with her baby and she works to repair that. Oh, sweetie, I wasn't very present for her. I've got to get present here. Okay. And then feeds her baby. Having gone not such a good direction and shifting to the new direction is amazing for the brain. They call that repair. And repair is better for the brain than if you had never been hurt. So isn't that amazing? All the pain that you've been through, it is to be transformed. And it is what will make you a lover like nobody's business. And it is done by Christ, who loves you and gave Himself up for you. So this is important because Jesus is inviting them to love. And you have to understand, the disciples were very human. They were very prone to arguments and who's better than who and all of those things. And love knows that. Love is not expecting a perfect community. In fact, it is really important for love to be real and true that we come face to face with the darkness. That we come face to the face with the hardness in our hearts and we love anyway. That is a part of the last days. That is what I see when I look at the New Testament. Paul is going on and on about, this is how you love, this is how you love, this is how you love. In fact, let's hear that. We'll go to 1 Corinthians 13. You know it. Everybody knows it. I touched it, Mike. I told him I wasn't going to touch the microphone, and I did. I'm confessing to
you.
Oh, thank you. I'm loved. No. So before I tell you what Paul said, he could have been a therapist in this chapter. I'm just saying, because this is the important thing to know. So when we are afraid and when we are hurt, we respond out of, you guys have heard of this, when we mount a defense, these are the things the defense comes from. Fight, you've heard this, flight, freeze, fawn, that's a new one, and collapse. Okay, this is important because we are so committed to our own safety. And this commitment is there. I'm saying this because in the Hobbit hole, there is an importance in safety. When your children are little, safety is vitally important for you to provide to them. Safe, seen, and soothed, vitally important. But as they come out into the world and experience life, it is your presence, not taking away pain, but your presence in pain that is part of that shift, right? But here's the thing, we mount this defense because if we didn't have good experiences of safety, we're especially into mounting a defense when we don't feel safe. And that defense is to fight someone, to run away from the situation, to freeze, I don't know what to do, I'm overwhelmed, to collapse, that looks like depression, shutting down, falling asleep, playing video games all day or scrolling my phone, dissociation, or fawning. Now, fawning is one that I believe Paul is talking about. And that's where sometimes we look like we're loving, but we're really trying to stay safe. So fawning is this action of doing the acts of love so that the person will like me and not hurt me. It's actually a really, really genius way of staying safe. In fact, the name of that came from, you know, people's experiences watching women in concentration camps who fawned over their captors in order to stay safe, and it was a brilliant strategy. And it is our strategy. And Paul is speaking to it right now. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have and if I deliver up my body to be burned, and in the I did look at the original, the Greek on this, it says, and boast, which I'm like, is he joking right there? Like, how can you boast when you're being burned? But anyway, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices with truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a woman, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, and then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But Paul said it, the greatest of these is love. It is the change agent, love. Being fully known by him, and then we will know. And then we will love one another. So, another piece of the puzzle about that is that you don't change with a list of rules and regulations. And I wanted to say this, and I think it's important. I'm just shooing it in here. But when people began to become aware about psychological issues for kids in school, and generally it's around behavior, they began to put up these teaching tools called social-emotional education, which makes sense because in school you learn. And so they went to teaching. And it became a rubric for kids for how to regulate. And, you know, it's like things like breathing, like in, you know, or take 5 seconds before you say something, or do this tool, or squeeze this thing. And what ends up happening is some of the kids can't do that because they haven't had an external regulator. And so they end up in my office, in my therapy office. And they end up there because the teachers have said, I've taught them, we've done all this stuff, and there's something wrong with them. You need to take on this on. And the parents are in distress. And this is what I have to tell them. That list on the wall will never work. Because they have to be shown love. And I'm not saying the parents don't love them. And there's a lot more to it than that. So don't take that as a criticism that way. But they have to know love in that moment. So if their teacher wants to regulate them, she would love herself in that moment. This is overwhelming. The kids are running around. She would take some breaths. And she would be really, really super present to them and to what's under their behavior and to what they need. And she would love them. Now, that doesn't mean she wouldn't be firm. That doesn't mean she would say, you can't be hitting your friend. I'm going to set you over here for a moment, right? That doesn't mean that. And I think Jesus does that with us too. It's not a doormat kind of situation. But it is, he looked beyond our fault and saw our need. He saw what was underneath for us, and he met us there. The woman at the well, the woman caught in adultery, Nicodemus, the man at the pool of Bethesda. He saw them where they were. He looked under the need, and he spoke from there. And he loved them, and he made a shift. And guess what? He's inviting us to, once we have known that love, be that love, to cast that wide net, like the fisher of men and women, people, to cast that wide net and bring people with us to the kingdom. Now, that's really beautiful to say. Again, that's the la la la, so beautiful. But it's really hard. It's really hard. In fact, if I were to invite you right now, you would probably say to me, I agree with you, Angie, that's right. And I would say to me, I agree with you, Angie, that's right. And there are people that I am armored up against in my world. There are people you are armored up against in your world. I'm not saying that you need to subject yourself to abuse or to stay with an abuser. So I want to be clear about that. You can love someone from far away by saying, I will not let you do this to me. That's okay. But what I'm saying is, if we all have people we are armored up against, we are like, not that one. You're asking me to invite to the kingdom, and I don't want to invite that one. And that is where Jesus wants to transform us. And what that tells me when I have that is that there's a part of me that I haven't invited him to see and transform. And sometimes he comes, in my inviting is kind of a wishy-washy thing sometimes. Sometimes he shows up like Gandalf. He's like, you haven't invited me, but I'm here. but that when I know that I'm armored up against someone, in whatever way, jealous, afraid of them, angry at them, there might be legitimate reasons, but I am armored up, and he invites me, he comes there to that spot. And I know that that means I still need transformation. I still have places in me where I don't believe the gospel. And he's transforming those. Now, to end this, I want to talk a little bit about the appendices of the Lord of the Rings. Now, just like John, and in the end, how he just feels like to me like he was loath to finish this story. Like he's just telling us all that Jesus said for three chapters. Tolkien was the same. After he finished his whole story that took forever and it had like never ending. In fact, when I first met my husband, we were reading through The Lord of the Rings together, and it went all the way into our first year of marriage. And when we got to the last chapter, he would pretend to fall asleep while I was reading so that I'd have to read it again the next night because we didn't want it to end. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. This story, we don't want it to end. It's so beautiful. This Christ is so beautiful. This invitation he gives us. And we don't ever want it to end. And so Tolkien, I think with that, he, and also because he's very particular about details, he created the appendices so that you could hear about the elves, where they come from, and the dwarves. Well, when Peter Jackson made the movies, he created appendices at the end. And they were basically documentaries on how the film was made. Things like lighting and costumes and set design, which was extensive. It was huge. Music, you know, like when you hear da-da-da-da-da-da-da. If you've seen the movies, you're all of a sudden there. Those people were so gifted and so unseen. And so the documentary covered all of that. And then the documentary, one of the documentaries, one of the appendices was on the cast. And it was interviews of each cast member alone. And it started out with kind of the typical, I mean, because the cast member were mostly young guys playing hobbits and were very silly, there was a lot of joking and a lot of, oh, like, Ian McKellen, he didn't like our music and he would just growl in the other room, grrr, you know, and like telling stories on each other and talking about how sometimes it was hard and some people irritated them. One person was really controlling, but they knew he loved them. But as the interviews go, you start to hear these different stories. And you realize that something transformative happened to these people. And they begin to talk about how much they loved working with the people that put on their makeup before they went out to do their acting, and how they forged bonds with them. And Viggo Mortensen, the guy who plays Aragorn, how he bought the horse that he rode for the movie and gave it to the trainer who helped him get ready for the movie because he loved her so much. And how, and then you hear them talking, and they're really, really, they start to say, we went through like divorces and losses of children and births of children and friend changes, and we all went through it together, and we were transformed. We were bringing this beautiful story together to the world, and we were doing it in community together, and it transformed us. Even at the end, some of them, you know, I don't know how much you know about filming, but, you know, at the end, they have to have callbacks, and they have to do certain scenes over again, and usually it's just one actor that comes and is standing there and gets filmed, and in the scene, there's another person, and they started coming to all of those, all of them, because they didn't want the actor to be alone for that. Like, this was like no other movie that you've seen, no other, like, they came together so tightly in love. And I think that as I think about the invitation to you all today, it is this. The road goes ever on. There are dangers out there. Maybe it's the last days. Maybe it's not. Maybe it feels like the last days. And what we, when I look and I ask in the scripture, what does Jesus want us of us in the last days? He just says, would you just believe my love? And will you step out the door? And will you join others in believing my love and be transformed in relationship with them? We are transformed by him, and then he puts us in relationship to continue that transformation. Relationships change us. And that is the invitation of today. And I hope you'll join me. I hope I'll join me. I got to tell you, there's a lot of days I don't want to do this journey. I'd rather scroll. I'd rather think about how bad things are. Oh, this is so bad. It's so interesting. But I'm called to something else, and I want to invite you with me. I love all that you guys brought in the beginning of this service. I think about that as being like, I couldn't have planned that. It was so beautiful. The songs, the prayers, you're there too. I always want to be able to see you guys. So on the night that Jesus was betrayed, which was actually right after the what we read about love one another, Jesus took the bread and he broke it and he said, this is my body given for you. Whenever you eat it, do in remembrance of me. Do so in remembrance of me. Remember me when you eat the bread. And then he took the wine and he said, this is my blood shed for you for the forgiveness of sins. Whenever you drink it, do this in remembrance of me. And so I invite you today to come and to take the bread and to drink the wine and to come as you are, to bring yourself as you are. It's okay. If you have despair, bring your despair. If you have fear, bring your fear. If you are armoring up against the world, bring that. If you are ashamed of yourself, bring it. Because that is where he will meet you, right there, with the blood and with the bread of his body and the wine of his blood. The dark cups are wine, the light cups are juice. I smelled it, Susan, to make sure. And come, it's all for you. I have a benediction I want to read to you. And I put it all the way across the stage, so I had to go over there. I want to say that you all are so precious. Like, there is goodness in all of us that God put in us when he created us. And we get trapped in this world. We get bound in this world. And we think this is all there is. And then we start to react out of protection. And we don't connect. And so just bring that to him. That's what I want to say. And this benediction, this is by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, who is a writer. She wrote Women Who Run With the Wolves, if you ever read that back in the, I don't know, 70s or something. No, you didn't. It's really cool. Women Run With the Wolves. It's really cool. But she wrote this in 2001, I believe. It's called Letters to a Young Activist in Troubled Times. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. It's quite wordy and long, but the last part of it I want to read to you. And she says some pretty strong things about not setting a table for despair. And I want to tell you that I don't want that to contradict my statement about come, if you're in despair, come with your despair. So I would say, do set a table, sit down with it and look at it. But she says, don't set a table. And there is a reason for that, and you'll understand in a minute. But I want to read this to you in closing. One of the most calming and powerful actions you can do to intervene in a stormy world is to stand up and show your soul. Soul on deck shines like gold in dark times. The light of the soul throws sparks, can send up flares, builds signal fires, causes proper matters to catch fire. To display the lantern in the soul of the soul in shadowy times like these, to be fierce and to show mercy towards others, both are acts of immense bravery and greatest necessity. Struggling souls catch light from other souls who are fully lit and willing to show it. If you would help to calm the tumult, that is one of the strongest things you can do. There will always be times in the midst of success right around the corner, but as yet still unseen, when you feel discouraged. I too have felt despair many times in my life, but I do not keep a chair for it. I will not entertain it. It is not allowed to eat from my plate. The reason is this: in my uttermost bones, I know something, as do you. It is, there can be no despair when you remember why you came to earth, who you serve, and who sent you here. The good words we say and the good deeds we do are not ours. They are the words and deeds of the one who brought us here. And the best part, in that spirit, I hope you will write this on your wall. When a great ship is in harbor and moored, it is safe. There can be no doubt. But that is not what great ships are built for. And I want to tell you to take courage, because we are all in the paws of the true Aslan, to mix stories. And watch this, and I'll see you on the road.